Our next speaker is not Dr. Moncrief, but it's Dr. Callender. He's the founder of the National MOTEP, which was founded at Howard University. The National MOTEP is the first national organization to address health disparities in the minority population. MOTEP has numerous satellite sites throughout this country, and donation rates have increased wherever these sites have been located. Dr. Callender, being the founder and president, is one of the experts in the field of organ donation, particularly as it pertains to minority involvement, and he's going to come and give us his views on presumed consent.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here, and at my age, it's a pleasure to be anywhere. As a matter of fact, my birthday is November 16th, and I'll be 77, so I'm very grateful to be around to talk about presumed consent, and so I'll share with you my views on the subject. Okay. Well, we start with definitions not too dissimilar to Alexandra. The definition of presumed is that you take something without permission. At least that's my perspective of it. I wouldn't say that the pejorative is that you're actually stealing, but it is to take something without permission. I mean, that's what presumed means. The assumption is made, therefore, that a particular action would have been approved by a person or party if permission had been sought. Consent means to agree, and presumed consent therefore means that you believe that the person involved would have agreed. That's what presumed consent is all about. The assumption is made, therefore, that a particular action would have been approved by a person or party if permission had been sought prior. Oh, am I going the wrong way? Now, I'm going to share with you some of the perspectives from Father Giorgio Ostracio, who's assistant professor of biology at Providence College in Rhode Island. And his perception is that presumed consent is a violation of the rule of informed consent. He further opines that the presumed consent undermines the dignity of the organ donor as a charitable gift giver, and further opines that Catholics and Catholic hospitals must reject presumed consent as an unjust and immoral system of organ procurement. Not me, that's what he says. Okay. Furthermore, informed consent affirms and protects the intrinsic dignity and inviolability of the human person. And Pope John Paul II considers organ donation as a noble gesture to give without reward a part of one's own body for the health and well-being of another. Not dissimilar in many ways to what the Christian belief is, that Christ came, died, and gave himself that we might have eternal life. So organ donation after death is a noble and meritorious act, and is to be encouraged as an expression of generous solidarity. Now, in my career as a transplant surgeon, and I've been a transplant surgeon now, this year marks 40 years since I've been a transplant surgeon. And I've been involved in increasing African-American donation rates since 1982 at least. So we're talking about 4 to 5 decades of my experience. And as a founder of the first two minority donor campaigns, actually the first two national minority donor campaigns, I've been educating and empowering minority communities to give consent for organ donation in spite of distasteful past histories. And the distrust of healthcare providers occurred as a consequence of a number of incidences. I will just address two of them make some implications relative to a third. The first is that the use of African Americans as human guinea pigs in the treatment of syphilis well after the discovery of penicillin in the 30s. And remember, we didn't fess up to this until in the 70s. That's 40 years. That incident has been a problem and a source of distrust that is well known. Secondly, the inequitable organ allocation that was racially discriminatory to African Americans because of the inappropriate application of HLA antigen and using them as a system by which organs were allocated. And that discriminatory practice was in place up until 2002. So we have to keep those things in mind. The distrust that this has created are definitely obstacles to obtaining donor consent and has required intensive community education strategies to restore this trust. So to me, to go from informed consent to presumed consent, which means no consent, would require a background of trust. And we, in fact, have the antithesis of this here in the United States. And I think the excellent two presentations that preceded me have pointed out that in 40 countries in the world where presumed consent has been used, it has led to increased donor rates. However, let me point out that many of these countries were relatively homogenous and have less of a background of distrust than those of the African-American population in the United States who have endured the Middle Passage or the diaspora. And for those who are unfamiliar, Middle Passage refers, and some of you have seen that movie, 12 Years After Slave, that very few people are seeing, by the way, which refers to the fact that we were brought over in boats through the Middle Passage and this diaspora. We were brought here not voluntarily, involuntarily, and then were enslaved as property for the next 400 years. And as such, we have to understand that that's the backdrop of what we're talking about here in the United States of America. And so, my final point is, while organ consent in the majority population may be a relative issue, because it's 7%, still not 100%, but it's 7%, less than the 75% that the previous speaker spoke of. But the consent rate for African Americans in most places across the country, there are exceptions in a number of states, but it's still less than 50%. Therefore, to me, the presumption of presumed consent here would be immoral. Thank you very much.
Ooh. I'd like to have all three of our panelists up there in the front, please. Thank you for those inspiring words and sharing that knowledge. And I'd like to open up the floor to some questions. Yes.
So if you were in a veil of ignorance and you didn't know if you would ever need a transplant or not, would you be incentivized to register as a donor if you knew that you would be given priority if you ever needed a transplant? You would be given priority if you had been a registered donor, and the answer would be yes, you probably would feel incentivized to register as a donor, and what would be the risks and registering as a donor, probably not much. So I think that reciprocity is a really good example of a non-monetary incentive because it's a personal incentive. It would impact individuals personally if they ever were to need a transplant, but it doesn't have a financial component. And it also remains an opt-in system. So you still have the option to say, you have to affirmatively say you want in. And I think the downside from ethicists and others who are concerned about reciprocity is whether it's coercive in the sense that, you're saying you may not have a good chance of getting a transplant unless you're willing to be a donor. And I think that the coercion aspect is weak only because the idea is that there'd be some removal in time between when you register. So again, if you want to address the free rider problem, you don't want it to be that as soon as someone finds out that they need a transplant, they can just go register and then they get priority. So it'd have to be something like percent of time that you've been registered since you were 18. There are certainly details that would have to be worked out to figure out how to operationalize something like this, but Israel is doing it right now, and they started with an extremely low donation rate, so they're already starting in a very different place than the U.S., but they've seen dramatic increases in just even the months leading up to when it was about to go into effect.
That's absolutely fascinating.
Yeah.
I think it flies in the face of some of Dr. Kalender's comments about distrust, particularly when you're talking about African Americans, though, because it seems like it would be contingent upon African Americans believing that they can get a transplant if they need one.
Well,
so it does raise
that issue, and I think it has to do with access. So the question legitimately could be raised, why should you be willing to give more if you don't have equal access to transplantation?
Yeah.
But it's also a catch-22 because without more African-American donors, it's still going to remain more difficult to have that transplantation access. So I think one of the other things I like about reciprocity is if it were really effective, it would eliminate itself over time so that ideally there would be enough organs to, make that incentive smaller and smaller to the extent that you normalize that behavior that people just, you become 18, you register as a donor. Just a thought.
To take your points further, in Germany, for example, you have two different layers of healthcare, and there's the state of sponsored healthcare, and then you can have private healthcare that you pay for. And if you opt out of the state sponsored healthcare, there's a 3-year period that you can't go back into the state-sponsored health care because you like to opt out. And so that could be one way of making sure that the system isn't gained in that way.
Okay.
But one of the other points we talked about, and again, forgive me, Alex, the list of arguments, but one was if you remove the gift component of it, you're making the system more of a commodification. It's probably a bad word.
Yeah.
And where I wanted to go with this is that there's already an incentive for people to be donors because on the other side, under the Social Security Act, end-stage renal disease is defined as a disability, and under Titles 18 and 19. Persons, they're given the option to receive dialysis and transplantation independent of the system that we already have. So they don't have to contribute, but they can consume the donations that come out of a national donor program. So, and again, how that is going to change over time with health care reform today and how health care continues to evolve, I don't know. But as dollars become more scarce and resources become more scarce, I think it will boil down to who's willing to contribute if you're also willing to receive.
Mm-hmm. Nobody has any more questions?
Oh, I have a question for you.
Yeah.
Yes. You know, given the backdrop of slavery, the Middle Passage, and incidents such as the Tuskegee experiment that you talked about, how can we move forward to a place where we can gain trust, not only of African Americans, but other multicultural groups, and even the majority?
Well, I think that it's important for us to impress upon particularly the minority communities of the United States that the majority of people who are waiting for transplants are minorities. More than 60% of those people who are waiting for transplants are minorities. We have more than close to 300,000 people on dialysis today. And when you look at the people who are being transplanted, only 20% of the white population is being transplanted, but only 10% of the minority population is being transplanted. So I raise that to say that it's important for us to really have public education efforts to empower the communities, majority and minority communities alike, so that we realize that it's important for all communities to become donor participants. Because frankly, I personally don't believe we will ever get to the point where we'll be able to get enough human donors, and so that we are going to eventually probably have to look to stem cells or to xenotransplantations to get enough donors. Because basically, if we optimize everything that we did, I doubt seriously if we could ever have enough donors to meet the needs. If we realize, for example, that out of those, we've never done more than 30,000 transplants in a year, and our disparity between those transplants and those waiting for transplants is some like 60,000 to 70,000 waiting. So, and we haven't even reached 30,000. So, somewhere along the line, if we educate the far our majority of community, minority communities, that they will do the best they can, I think that's important. And I think the education is important. But I still believe that even if we do all of that, we're still going to have a shortfall, and therefore it's going to be important for us to have equitable availability for the stem cell transplants when they come, the xenotransplants when they come. Otherwise, we will still be on the outside looking in for those things happen. So, therefore, more empowerment of our communities, to me, is a very critical and important next step.
I would just add, too, that the way different communities authorize donation varies significantly. And so, you know, I know just in New England we've looked at this, and other areas of the country have looked at this, too, and you can see that, for example, some of our Hispanic communities have a very high consent rate for family consent, but very low donor registration rates. So we still get at a reasonably high authorization rate overall, but as a cultural matter, they would prefer the family to make the decision than for it to be a registration decision. And so that's really important when you're gearing community education efforts to understand that for that culture, it's going to be about family decision making versus sign up at the registry, whereas for some communities it's the exact opposite. So, you know, I think that starting to drill down at some micro level on how authorization is best implemented, basically, you know, within communities is going to be really important to driving the numbers up.
That's a very important point because, according to law, we have the right of first refusal, person has the right to decide to donate, regardless of what the family does. So when you come into the Latino or Hispanic, are we at odds with what their culture is all about? Because theoretically, if somebody is registered donor and decides to donate, and the family disagrees, and the hospital does not pursue the case, theoretically, the Attorney General can actually sue the hospital for not doing what is the legal right, which is to respect the rights of the registered donor.
Right, and I guess what I'm saying, though, is that more often than not, in some particular communities, we're not, there's not a registered donor, but the families consent at a very high rate.
That's right.
So that, for those communities, the education ought to be geared towards sort of family authorization, whereas some communities, the donor registry is really going to be driving the rates up. So
the education is registered to become a donor, and for families to accept the fact that when they become aware that their loved one was registered, to accept that and not to push back.
Here's another question
now,
for you.
If I could add, for those in the public health arena, when you go back home and you have a website that you have a homepage for, it would be great to have a link to your donor registration, to your organ donor program. So that's something that every county, every public health office potentially has the ability to do to help educate the population, because that link could not only register the person to be a donor, but also could take them to the site where they can gain more information about becoming a donor and some of the disparities and some of the questions that maybe cause them not to register.
I would also like to say that there's been a tremendous emphasis on educating people in the hospital about the importance of asking families and potential donors. So much so that sometimes you think that it takes away from the emphasis that should be placed on public education. Because I see public education as a very critical frontier that cannot be put in second place. But as a consequence, really more recently, that has been the situation. But I would raise the issue of reminding us of the importance of community education and empowerment as being one of the most important ways of making this happen.
I'd just like to make a statement that I forgot to make in the beginning, that there's no financial incentives for any of these presenters to be presenting on this topic. Now, having said that, are there financial incentives out there in other countries for organ donation, and how are they impacting on those countries that have presumed consent laws?
The country of Iran, they have an incentive. It's an extra layer of healthcare. So if somebody comes forward to give a donation, a living donation, it is permissible for the recipient to pay the donor. And then the government does pay for healthcare, additional healthcare for the donor. And so they ensure that it's taken out of the shadows and there's not this black market for exchange of donor-recipient organs. So it's above board, it's out front, it's out of the shadows, and the donor does receive good, sufficient health care. And their transplant wait list is the lowest in the world.
That's right.
Yeah, although that said, you know, all of the other countries we've discussed have the same prohibition we do in the U.S. as against buying or selling organs, and the WHO strongly supports the prohibition on buying and selling organs, including any kind of financial incentive. So I think they're a real outlier compared to other countries.
Okay.
Now there is an incentive to be a living donor, for example, where if you then subsequently need a kidney or an organ transplant and you were a living donor, you're placed higher at the top of the list to receive a transplant from a deceased donor.
Which is sort of this reciprocity idea,
exactly.
That
yeah.
If you're willing to give, you know, you should have some priority to receive.
And so there's a precedent for moving to a reciprocity type system where you incentivize people to opt in to a donor registry, and then if they need a transplant, then they're higher up on the list, which is the Israeli model.
Okay. But that's not true here now, though.
For living donors, they're given some priority if they ever need a transplant. That's true now.
That is
the
true.
US.
Yes,
please. Yeah.
Okay, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
So.
Then the financial
most living donors don't ever need a transplant. Hopefully.
Then the new program with financial incentives for living donors is something that is over the last 3 years, which has resulted in a significant increase in living donor transplantation. In which they, if you have a living donor who wants to donate but doesn't have the finances to transportation, they will get a credit card that will allow them to move from one place to another. And I think that's something that they were signed to transplant surgeons. Gotten a grant from the government, which is, I guess, over $1 million, and has helped increase living donations. So it's financial incentive, which ordinarily would have been illegal.
Yeah, well, what it is it's removing financial disincentives.
That's
so
right.
What they're trying to do is just that's make sure it doesn't cost the living donor anything to be a donor, but it's not intended to provide any money beyond cost.
That's right.
Yeah.
Are there other questions? If not, I'd like us to give a round of applause to our panel for participating.
I'd like to give the audience
for coming.
Let me ask a question.
Yes.
Stigma aside,
you know, you would personally benefit from not being infected, right? So there's this personal vested interest aspect of it. So then you say, well, how do you enhance the health behavior that's low vested interest, high ambivalence? And the literature suggests it through personal experience, but you can't have everybody have a personal experience around the table.
Or reciprocity.
Right, or reciprocity. And then you say, well, how do you harness existing experiences into the public education that Dr. Callender was talking about? And I think that that's where some of the conversation can be, you know, increasing awareness, increasing knowledge through people's personal experiences, so that other people don't have experience in person, but can learn through others.
And I concur, but my only pushback
is
that in a public health crisis where hypertension and diabetes is the conversation of the day, the natural connection of those two diseases to this particular, I don't understand that.
So I think our field is so focused on primary. I think we spend more energy thinking primary and secondary than tertiary prevention. And by the time you get to ESRD, you're talking tertiary prevention, right? And I don't know that our field does enough in that
area. Well, just to chime in on it, I think that the educational component is something that's missing here. The connection between the hypertension, the diabetes, and the shortage of organs is, for someone who's looking at and in the field of organ donation and procurement, it's right there in your face. It's just so obvious. How could you miss it? But for someone who's out there doing all these other different things, looking at water, looking at breastfeeding, looking at birth control, we do so many different things in public health, and that's what I was saying about the size of the book and the presenters in this meeting, that unless there's something out there that says, hey, you're missing this direct connection that all these things, all these chronic diseases are going to lead to unless, you know, you do something to prevent them, you're not going to get people in here, okay? And unless people personally experience it, and this is what I was sharing with Rich a little bit earlier. When we walk around with our shirts on, it says Gift of Life or something, people are walking up to us and asking, and sharing experiences that they had, but there's no place for them to go and talk about those experiences. And part of what this panel is about, and part of what I see our mission being, and it just seems to be harder work than I thought it was going to be, is providing a place for people to come and provide that information. See, when we talk about presumed consent, we're way down the road on organ donation. And unless you know what presumed consent means, if you're flipping through that book of 500, different topics, you're going past it, okay? And what we need to do, and I'm just thinking about this, as we are in this moment, what we need to do is step back and help people join draw those lines, those connections between hypertension and diabetes, because these are the public health experts that are walking around here. If they don't get it, then, how are we expecting our lay people to get it? So we need to do a better job of drawing that connection for them, bringing them in with terms like, we're talking about organ donation and transplantation. Okay, and when we get them in the room, and they already will have some level of understanding, then we help educate them a little bit more on that, and then we take them to topics such as presumed consent. I think we just bought them too quick. And I don't know, I'm just looking at who is in here as our audience. If you guys are present at the Black Caucus for Community Health Workers luncheon a few days ago. Okay. We had a room of about, 75 people. And it was, I shared this with Rich too. We had presented the year before to them and they were all excited and so forth. And we came back and presented again this year, but we did something different. We actually surveyed them on their knowledge of presumed consent and how they felt about it. And first thing that we noticed was all that big response. The number, it was like doing any other survey. The numbers decreased on who responded. Number two, when we actually looked at the results of it, half of them understood what presumed consent was, but, you know, almost half of them didn't understand. Okay? So what we learned from that was we needed to do a little bit more education to the group who, you know, who is actually sponsoring this session. And that's okay, because that's what, you know, we're about. But again, if the leadership doesn't understand, how can we expect the people out there, the lay people, to? So we've got a big task ahead of us. So I really appreciate the audience, you know, that showed up today, okay? And I appreciate the audience that we had a few days ago, because I learned from them.